I felt myself at last an utter outcast, yes, indeed an outcast, cast forth alike from the society of men and devils. This was the end of all my desperate striving against fate. Oh, that ghastly silence! Utter, absolute solitude! He ceased. Chapter 18, The Bottomless Pit, Letter from the Officer, May 23. How can I convey to you the awful solitude of the lowest depth of hell? No words of mine can ever make you realize it. Nothing else could ever have broken my proud spirit as that did. Absolutely abandoned, forsaken, alone. Neither sight nor sound, not another soul, alone, absolutely alone, with one's own thoughts. They rose before me and gibed and jeered all the evil that I had ever done. I did not repent then, I did not even feel remorse, but I felt a wild, hopeless despair. These thoughts seemed to take form and shriek at me, "You are damned. Look at us. We are the things which you have begotten. What right have you for hope? All your life has been given up to evil, till not even the most abandoned will associate with you. We cannot forsake you, we would if we could." Then again came darkness, it seemed almost like annihilation. I opened my mouth to scream, but no sound came out. The darkness seemed to flow in and stop it. Their mouths shall be stopped with dust. I seemed vaguely to remember the phrase, but where it came from I did not care. Oh, that awful loneliness! I would have done anything to get back even to the whips of the evil spirits above, but it was not to be. Absolutely crushing silence. I cannot convey to you the awfulness of that solitude. You may think that the pains of the divisions above were worse, but it was not so. Ages seemed to pass, and those terrible words came ringing in my mind, "Damned eternally." Then again Dante's words, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." Yes, all hope. I felt it, and so for what seemed endless ages, I suffered in solitude. Suddenly a phrase came into my mind, and I grasped its full meaning, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" He who hung upon the cross knew intuitively its awfulness and the despair of those who lay here. Forsaken of God, never till now had I understood the meaning of that sentence. It had seemed to me absurd, but now I saw as by a lightning flash he knew the sufferings of all, even those in the bottommost pit. Think what you please of the story of the crucifixion, I care not, but this I do know, that he knew of our sufferings and realized it, and he alone of all who trod this earth knew it while on it. As this thought sank in, I did not at first attach any particular meaning to it. But as time wore on, it came to me that there must be some significance in it. If he intuitively knew our sufferings, he who was all-merciful must feel some shreds of pity for us. Doubtless he could not help us. As a tree falls, so shall it lie. Still, if he still lived anyway and if I did, surely he would. He must feel pity for me. A new sensation grew by degrees. Why had I been such a fool? Why had I not tried by repentance to get out of hell? But there, what was the use? I was in hell and I could not, for hell is eternal. But I thought and thought. At any rate it was pleasanter to think of Christ than of other things. Why not go on thinking of him? I cannot say that I felt any genuine regret for my past life, but I began to feel that I had been a fool, I had wasted my chances. "Well," I cried, "I must pay the price. I shan't whine now, I never did on earth, and I'm not going to start now." But somehow that scene on Calvary seemed to haunt me. It came as a refreshing interlude amid my other thought pictures. Then there came a new thought. I remembered my mother, I wondered where she was. She died when I was quite young, but I remembered her, and could remember how she used to teach me to pray. What was it? I could not remember. Funny, I could remember everything else, but not those prayers. Strange. Well, I'd always heard that the damned could not pray, and I was damned. I did not realize it, but in a feeble sort of way I was praying, or at least yearning, after better things. This was the turning point. How I got out I will tell you later, but this was the first faint beginning. Now I win break off. I wanted to leave you with the tense of hope, not of hopelessness, for though I did not realize it, this was the beginning of better things. I had at last reached the bottom, and soon I would start on the upward path. I had gone the full course and had reached the lowest depths, and yet, his mighty arm was strong to save. Glory be to God on high. Indeed, there is no such thing as death, neither of the good nor bad, but perpetual hell would be death, for it means permanent separation from God. The Officer. Witnessed by K., May 23, 1914. Chapter 19, The First Upward Step. Transvision, May 25, 1914. The officer having sat down began at once. How long I remained in that awful solitude I have no idea, but it seemed like centuries. Anyway, at length an inspiration came to me, sent, I believe, from above in answer to my inarticulate prayers. It was, turn towards God, He can help you, and no one else can. Turn towards God. It was a new idea. My whole life had consisted in turning deliberately away from Him. How could I turn towards Him even now? Yet what would I not do to get out of this awful place? Again and again my mind reverted to the idea. But how could I go towards Him? How could I get out of this awful spongy darkness? Besides, I was damned. Another idea flashed into my mind. Why not pray? I tried the Lord's Prayer, but could not manage it. I had forgotten how to pray. At length, like an inspiration, the words suddenly burst from my lips, O God, help me. Once spoken they came easier, and I repeated them again and again. What followed next, and, indeed, the whole of my process of getting out of this deepest depth, will, I am afraid, be very difficult for you to understand. It is next to impossible to find words adequate to describe these experiences. Well, the first effect of this praying was to produce what seemed like a pleasant sensation of warmth, and this warmth grew and grew until it became far too hot. Finally, I seemed to be afire. The more I prayed, the more intense grew the heat, till at length I ceased to pray, hoping it might stay the pain. But it still continued. Then I became aware of a new sensation. I seemed to be growing lighter, and gradually I realized that I was slowly rising up through the spongy darkness. What had happened was, that by praying even so feebly I had begun to burn away a little of the grossest part of my nature which had rendered my spiritual body so heavy. Thus it became too light to remain stuck in that darkness, and gradually rose and rose, till at last I saw jutting out from the darkness what seemed like a black and slippery rock at the edge of some beetling cliffs. Though this phrase would not be adequate, yet if you consider this lowest depth as a deep lake of utter darkness with forbidding cliffs all around, you will get some idea. As soon as I saw this black, slippery rock I tried to climb onto it, but slipped off again and again. By this time the burning sensation had ceased, and, encouraged by the evidence I had just received of the benefits of prayer, I tried it again. O God, help me to get out of this darkness. I had hardly done so when the lake of darkness, upon which I was now floating instead of in it, became agitated. Great waves rose up round me, and seemed as if they would engulf me. Instead, however, I was lifted up and hurled on to the rock. It was as if the dark waters would no longer contain me on their bosom, and therefore cast me ashore. I have little doubt that in part this was the case. You see, bad as I still was, I was yet too good to remain there now, and so was cast up on the shore of the second lowest division. The darkness was still intense, but not so tangible, but when I commenced to investigate my surroundings, I must admit my heart sank. The rock seemed to jut out like a table from a high cliff, and at first I could find no path by which to climb it. Remembering how useful prayer had been before, I again essayed its benefits. For some time nothing happened, and I began to lose heart. But at length my sight seemed to become clearer, for I was able to detect a hole in the cliff a short distance to the left of the flat rock. I found that I could just reach it with one hand, and having tried many parts of the cliff with my foot, at length found a sort of step or hole broken or cut in the cliff, into which I placed my foot. After several more desperate struggles I reached the cave's entrance, and on climbing into it found that, after running some distance inland, it opened into a kind of narrow gully. Now I'm afraid that all this must sound fearfully physical, but you must bear in mind that to us superphysical beings, superphysical rock seems almost physical, and, in any case, when describing it to you we cannot convey the finer distinctions for which there are no words or symbols. This fact must be fairly intelligible to you, for look how natural in many ways is this spirit world to which you are permitted to come. By means of infinite toil and effort I was able slowly to climb up this gully, and after a while reached a spot some way up the cliff. Here I found a ledge of rock which ran along the side of the cliff for some distance, and followed it. In due course this, too, ended, and I almost gave way to despair. Had I struggled so far only to fail at last? I crouched down and thought, but as I could discover no way out, I began to pray again, but without much hope. However, the mere action of praying seemed to soothe my troubled spirit, and at length, encouraged by it, I rose and again searched for a way out. Suddenly there was a roar like thunder, and a massive rock fell forward from the face of the cliff and jammed across the narrow gully close by where the path had broken off. This made a steep, sloping bridge. I could not see from where I stood whether the further end of the bridge led onto another path or ledge, but I felt sure that it had fallen in answer to my prayers. With infinite pains I scrambled onto this rough bridge. Several times I feared that I should pitch into the chasm below, but still I struggled on. At length I reached the top of the sloping stone bridge, and found that the chasm wall on the other side was more like screes than a sheer precipice. Up this I painfully struggled, often slipping back, but still persevering. My iron will stood me in good stead in this predicament. At length it was done, and I crawled onto comparatively level ground, rough and bouldery though it was, with a sigh of relief. I was back once more in the second division of hell. At the same time a new fear seized me. Should I again see those devils? But nothing happened, no one came, and in time a new terror presented itself to my mind. Had I, after all, not left the lowest depth, was I still in that awful solitude? For a moment despair gripped me. Were all these painful efforts in vain? Were the apparent answers to my prayers a mockery, the scorn of an angry God who would never be appeased? But soon other thoughts came. The darkness, though still here, was not the same, it was not tangible, it was the darkness of the second division. So again came hope. Now you must leave us. Chapter 20, Back in the Second Division. Vision. The Officer's Narrative. June 1, 1914. After greeting me, the officer proceeded at once with his narrative. I scrambled painfully over the stony ground without any particular object in view save to get away from the crevasse up which I had crawled. This journey continued for some time, until in the distance I heard a faint sound and made towards it. Presently I began to recognize the noise. It was the screams of the unfortunate beings flying before the whips of the devils. I stopped. What should I do? I had no wish to suffer again that torment, and yet I dreaded solitude. However, I was not left long in doubt, for suddenly a herd of spirits came rushing out of the darkness pursued by their tormentors. Next moment I was caught by the crowd and had to rush with them. After being hunted for some time, I began to wonder whether I could not discover some method of escaping from these terrible whips. By my side was running a man, and at length I said to him as we stumbled along, "Look here, can't we get out of this?" "I would to God we could," he moaned. "Who's that using the name of God here?" "Take that, and that," screamed one of our tormentors, and at each word his fearful whip lashed us both. As we still ran on I noticed that the ground seemed not merely rougher, but beyond this rough ground lay high cliffs with clefts and gullies in which we might hide. So we began to edge our way to that side of the herd. Presently I murmured to my companion, "Now." We raced for the shelter of the rocks, but at once one of the devils started in pursuit. It was a wild, desperate race, but of course we were recaptured. However, I shouted to my companion, "Call on God to help us, I find that even here he can." Then suiting my actions to my words I cried, "O God, help us, for Christ's sake." "Silence!" yelled our captor. "God cannot help you here. He is just. You have rejected him, and now he rejects you." "Silence! You cannot pray. If you try, he will not hear. He has other things to do than listen to traitors like you. Are there not enough souls not yet damned who need his aid that he should hearken to you? Back to the others. Again and again the terrible whip lashed our bodies. But still I prayed on. Soon, however, my companion lost heart and rushed back to the crowd, hoping amid the others to be partly protected from the blows of the lash. Almost at the same moment I perceived that a little nearer the cliffs was a black, shiny pool unutterably filthy. Without an instant's hesitation I plunged straight in. Whatever the substance was, it certainly was not the same tangible darkness I had experienced before in the division below. It much more resembled filthy water, thick and greasy with slime and dirt. I endeavored to swim across this, still for a while pursued by my tormentor, who lashed at me if ever I rose above the surface. Still calling upon God for help, I struggled on, and at length reached the further shore. At the foot of the high precipice I crouched and prayed desperately. Almost at once I saw a thin cord hanging round my waist. On looking closer I perceived it was a chain with many links, and as I studied them I knew they were the few good deeds I had ever done. I had never noticed them before, but now, few as they were, they seemed to give me courage. An idea came floating into my mind and even as it did so I again felt the lash of the pursuer. However, I paid no heed to it, but quickly unwound the chain, which I discovered was woefully thin, but at the same time much longer than I had expected. I formed one end into a noose, and studied the face of the cliff in spite of the blows which were continually being rained upon me. I soon perceived a horn of rock, as it were, which jutted out, and above it appeared to be a narrow ledge. After several efforts I succeeded in catching the noose over this horn and then began to climb up the chain, hand over hand. Every moment I feared it would break, but I kept on praying desperately, and it seemed as if the chain grew stouter as I did so. For a while the devil behind still lashed and struck, but after a time I appeared to climb out of his reach, and at length I scrambled onto the ledge, but I could see nothing because of the awful darkness. I looked next for the chain. But this too had vanished. For a time I gave myself up to despair, but after a while wiser thoughts prevailed, and instead of despairing, I knelt down and thanked God that He had helped me so far. Feeling calmer, I proceeded slowly on my way. The ledge was but narrow, and a false step would have meant a fall clean over the edge of the cliff. By degrees it grew a little broader, and soon I was able to walk along in comparative ease. Well, I thought, it just shows what can be done if one only has a strong will. Most men would have given up the task as hopeless. But I'm not of that type, thank goodness, I have an iron will. This was no sooner thought than, catching my foot on a boulder, I pitched forward over the ledge. Down I fell with a fearful speed, but did not fall far, as I stuck head downwards in a narrow crevasse. It was only after many desperate struggles that I succeeded in freeing myself and painfully climbed up to the place from whence I had fallen. In a more chastened spirit I continued slowly on my way. At times the route was over bare screes, upon which I slipped and fell, at others over rough boulders and jagged rocks, while again at other times it was along a comparatively easy path. At length I came to the entrance of a cave and wafted in. It seemed, strange to say, less dark here than outside. Suddenly, while turning a corner, I was attacked by four men, who knocked me down, and, after hammering me all over, tied me up, a prisoner. I should say here that though I struggled to the best of my ability, I found I was much weaker than I had been when last in this division. This was due to the fact that there were stirrings of better things, and these, though they helped me to rise higher, yet rendered me weaker in opposing evil to evil and strength to strength. I must stop now, but I will just add this, I was once more in the third division, and about to suffer some of the pain similar to that which I had formerly inflicted on others. The officer rose. I find it cursed hard work to learn, he added, and passed out through the door. Chapter 21, In the Third Division. A Library in Hell. The Isis Narrative, June 8, 1914. The men who had captured me beat me thoroughly to show you who is master, as they said. I remembered how I had often done the same, and tried to resist, but found that some subtle change had come over me. It was not exactly that my will had grown weaker, but that my will to do evil had grown weaker. I was therefore at a great disadvantage in trying to protect myself. The law was of course self-acting, but at the same time it tended to make me progress, for it rendered life very miserable, and begot a longing to escape. For a long time I struggled in the grasp of my captors, enduring all manner of tortures. But at length I got my opportunity and escaped. My tormentors started in pursuit, but though my will to do evil was weakened, yet my will to escape was strengthened if anything, and I quickly outdistanced them. I rushed along in the darkness over a stony plain for what seemed like weeks and weeks, hardly meeting a soul, and those few I met I avoided. At last I stumbled up against what appeared to be a huge building. After a little careful reconnoitering I discovered it was a library. I was at once struck with an idea. There now seemed a hope, faint yet ever present, that I should ultimately escape from hell. If that were so, I ought in the interest of science to explore it as far as possible. I determined therefore, though not without a great deal of trepidation, to enter the building. You have been hearing about libraries in the realm above this, nor was it entirely by accident that P. and I should both speak of similar subjects at about the same time. The one is the natural corollary to the other. Having entered the library, I was at once met by an evil-looking old man. You understand, he looked old, and very evil. "I want to look over the library," I began. "Certainly, my son," he replied. "This library is much patronized by the wise. Those who would triumph in hell must study even as they do on earth. Is that not so?" "Of course, of course." "Is this library restricted to the subject of hate, or are other subjects such as lust included?" "He." "Mainly hate and cruelty. Though a little lust of course has to be included. But lust as lust goes to its own library near the cities of lust. You should go there and study a little, it's well worthwhile." We then entered the library. It was an enormous place, and was divided into three sections: 1, book forms; 2, idea books; 3, living thought visualizations. Among the forms were all books dealing with cruelty and hate for their own sake. I saw their shelves filled with the records of the Inquisition, books describing methods of poisoning your foes, books relating hideous crimes and savage tortures, histories of torture, so-called medical works, and so on. I looked at one of these medical works. "What decides whether a book come to hell or not? For example, this book is on vivisection. It's a French work. Do all books on that subject come here?" He replied, "No. Indeed, it is all a case of the object of the work, and also the results it produces. With all books on vivisection, as with the thing itself, both object and result count. For example, believing he has a cure for some disease, a doctor inoculates some animals with that disease, tries his treatment, and afterwards publishes an account of his experiments. The sole object of the man has been to improve the well-being of his fellow men, and his book has that object. In such a case, of course, we should not get his book. But many men, especially on the continent, inflict torture on animals simply out of a morbid curiosity to see how pain works. As no useful object is served by these experiments, and the publication of them only incites others to do likewise, the books come here and so naturally do their authors. Again, a scientist may conduct some experiments with a laudable motive, yet it may be extremely foolish or even wrong for him to publish such experiments broadcast. Such a book will often lead others to perform similar experiments out of curiosity or the love of inflicting pain. Such a book comes here." I said, "Then I take it that most vivisectionists come here?" He. "Oh, we get quite a large number, but still not as many as you would expect. A good many of these men, though they seem a bit callous and are so, yet are genuinely moved by laudable, though often mistaken, motives. But still a very large number would come to us if it were not for the time they spend on the astral plane. You see, they usually fall victims to the vengeance of the animals they have tormented, and this and a clearer vision of the truth causes them to regret what they have done, and leads them to strive to make amends." "How?" "Oh, by encouraging men on Earth to found societies for the prevention of cruelty to animals and such nonsense. Still, the so-called cause of science sends us many companions. How are the scientists arranged for? Oh, in different ways. Take the doctors, for example. We have a hospital not far from the library. A hospital, I cried with surprise. Yes, but here we don't make any pretense of running it for the good of the patients. It's all done in the interests of science, he. But you ought to go round and see it for yourself, that is, if you are not afraid of being operated on yourself, he. We wandered on into the second section, and here I saw the idea books. Each contained pictures instead of writing, and they were similarly devoted to cruelty, hate, and so forth. Every ingenious device for torturing the human body, and even the spiritual body, was displayed. Nor was that all, for there were diabolically clever ways of tormenting the mind. But the third section was the worst. Here at the sides of the room were countless pictures in which we could see the anguish of the victim as he was slowly tortured, while at the two ends of the room were stages upon which were enacted various diabolical torments. All these were acted before us. The attendant said, "These rooms are devoted to works which describe the best ways to torture persons and the exact effects of any particular kind of torture, or, as we call it, operation. You see, we cannot here inflict pain unless we understand the effect of that pain. Thus, the more fully we understand a particular torment, the easier it is to make another suffer that pain if we are strong-willed enough to subdue him." Among the pictures I perceived many dealing with the vivisection of men, which were too horrible to describe. I discovered I was getting a bit squeamish as I looked at the atrocities. Still, it is only fair to say I had never been cruel for cruelty's sake. Callous at times, very revengeful and entirely reckless, I certainly was, but not cruel simply for the sake of seeing others suffer. Chapter 22. A hospital in hell. After a while I left the library, and crossing a barren waste came to the so-called hospital. If the library had been gruesome, this place was a perfect nightmare. I passed through a gateway, and entered a large but dirty hall. This is rather different to a hospital on Earth, I thought, for they usually carry the case for cleanliness almost too far. The dirty hall led into an operating theater. I entered, and saw that on the table a man was stretched out. He was fastened in such a way that he could not move, but otherwise appeared perfectly normal. The doctor then began some fearfully painful operation on one of the nerve centers. The shrieks of the victim, and the ghoulish delight of the audience, was more than I could stand, hardened sinner as I was. I therefore slipped out and found myself in the dissecting room. Here living men, yes, and women were being dissected. As soon as one mangled body was left, it began to assume its original form again, and as soon as this was noticed, another operator would begin upon it once more. I noticed a woman who was being dissected by a young-looking doctor pleading desperately with him to let her go. He hesitated for a moment, but a sharp word of reproof from an older man who was at work on a neighboring table hardened his heart, and he recommenced his work. I stepped up to him. "Who is this woman, and why do you torture her so? Has she done you some wrong?" He replied, "I know nothing about her or why she is here. You can ask her yourself if you like." So I turned to her, and she, reprieved for the moment, said, "My name was Ninai, and I lived in Paris. I was a demi mundane, and was for 3 years the mistress of a Jew. One day he caught me in an intrigue with a young actor, and there and then turned me out of the house, beating me black and blue. I was furious, and swore I would be revenged both on him and on my cowardly lover, who, instead of defending me, had run like a rabbit. It was not long before I got my opportunity. I fell in with the leader of a band of Apaches. He was rather a handsome, gentlemanly man in looks, and did not belong to the class of the ordinary Apache. He was an awfully cunning rascal, and absolutely ruthless. I told him the Jew had a lot of money hidden in the house, and egged him on to break in. One night the band did so, and I went with them. The Jew was rather an old miser, and only had one servant, a man who slept in, besides a woman who came in each day. The house was a decayed place in one of the suburbs of Paris. One of the band knocked the manservant senseless, and then we rushed into the Jew's bedroom and tied and gagged him.